Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm John Traphagen, an anthropologist and professor in the Department of Religious Studies and the Program in Human Dimensions of Organizations at the University of Texas at Austin. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Ardith Thalmung to talk about her recent book, Everyday Economic Survival in Myanmar, which was published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2019. Professor Thalmung, thank you for joining me on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have you here. And of course, we've had many conversations in the past, so I'm looking forward to continuing our discussions. I want to begin with a little bit of background about Professor Thalmung. She's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, which also just happens to be the department where I received my BA degree awfully long time ago before she was part of the department. She received her PhD in political science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and her master's in international relations from Yale. She has held both Fulbright and Fulbright-Hays fellowships, and her research covers a range of topics focused on Myanmar, from including internal migration, ethnic conflict, and most recently, social media and democracy. I usually start these interviews by asking authors how they became interested in the topic of their book, and in the introduction, you actually go into some detail about your own background growing up in Myanmar and how you were engaged in certain forms of daily economic activity. So I'd like to begin by asking you to talk about those experiences and how you think they influenced your career as well as your research and writing of this book.
Well, John, first of all, thank you so much for having me here and for a wonderful introductions about me and my book. I was born and raised in Burma, which is now known as Myanmar. And I grew up in the 70s and 80s under a one-party political system controlled by the military that practiced socialist and isolationist policies. Myanmar is also a very diverse country consisting of about 100 different language groups, but Burma or Buddhists are the majority. Since the country became independent from Great Britain in 1948, it has experienced civil war between government, army, and minority groups that took up arms for greater autonomy against Burman-dominated government and military. So as a member of minority ethnic and religious group in a war-torn country, which also happens to be one of the poorest and most authoritarian countries in the world, I have always been passionate about finding out the reasons why some countries remain poor and undemocratic, while others, especially those in our neighboring countries, have done better economically and politically. So these experiences influence the paths I have chosen in my professional career, as well as areas of concentrations, which are, as you have mentioned, ethnic conflicts, political economy, and democratization. And this particular book project was motivated by my experiences growing up in Burma, especially on a variety of coping strategies myself and my family members used to deal with poverty and authoritarian political system. which are also resonate with the experiences of millions of other Burmese citizens who try to overcome economic challenges they face on a daily basis. So the book project allows me to engage in a more systematic analysis of different types of these coping strategies that have been used by ordinary people in the country and how they have an impact on individual and collective welfare and the economy and the political system.
Yeah, I think in the introduction, you actually talk about some of the things you personally had to do. Can you talk a little bit about some of these? Because they were really fascinating and engaging.
Yes. So in my book, I talk about, categorize these coping strategies into four different categories, economic coping, social coping, political coping, and psychological coping. And when I was growing up in the 80s, most of the strategies that we used were economic coping strategies, especially after 1988. All the universities were closed because of the popular demonstrations against the military regime, and that the military took harsh measure against the protester by basically killing thousands of student-led demonstrations and eventually closed down the university. So I was a university student, and all of a sudden I found myself not having anything to do. So I started looking for different economic opportunities. I became a pig broker. So that was one of the jobs that I had it for almost a year. In Burma, most people try to have additional income by raising their pigs. And but eventually the idea here is to slaughter the pig and to earn additional money. But they ended up not wanting to kill their own animal because they develop attachment to it. So I became a pig broker. I went around the neighborhood, and I have a partner who is a butcher, and I would partner with him, and every month we would kill a couple of pig, and we will sell the meat for higher profits, and that's one of the ways in which I make some additional income when I was growing up in the country in the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating part of the book. As you read through that, you realize you were living this in addition to ultimately winding up studying this particular lifestyle. And I think that adds a great deal of depth to the book as well, because you have this kind of really deep understanding of what life is like as people are trying to figure out how to deal with these economic realities and basically make a living as best as one can. I think it was interesting to me that early in the book, you talk about the importance of examining what you refer to as everyday politics, and you differentiate this from more restricted views of politics as belonging to the realms of government, because they miss a great deal of behavior that is, truly politically significant. And for me as an anthropologist, and of course, because I'm an anthropologist, I tend to work at the micro scale of societies. I work in small communities. I found this to be a very important point in terms of thinking about political behavior. And I note that it really shapes the argument of the entire book. And so could you talk a bit about what you mean by everyday politics and why it's important for political scientists to develop research around this area?
Yes, political scientists tend to focus, and like anthropologists, political scientists tend to focus on larger issues such as elections, government structures, and major arenas of public policy making. But everyday politics, everyday activities in private realms have been ignored by many political scientists. One political scientist, Ben Covliet, who also happened to be my mentor, described everyday politics as as activities undertaken by families, neighborhood, religious groups, corporations that focus on distribution of key resources. And these everyday activities can be as simple as attempt to cut basic expenses in food, education, healthcare, or engage in second or third jobs to have additional income, or buying lottery tickets to make money, or seeking help from religious leaders and astrologers to deal with economic challenges. They can also include attempts to negotiate with authority figures who are responsible for, you know, one's economic problems. So Kovlid argued that many of these activities reveal no overt political message, involve little or no organization, and they occur by means of low-key, subtle expressions that indirectly or privately endorse or resist prevailing rules and orders and establishment. In my book, I find that the accumulations of these daily activities can have impact on the larger political structures. In fact, these everyday activities were attributed to the collapse of collective farmings in China or political and economic reforms that took place in other poor and non-Western countries. It is therefore important for me that political scientists look at this micro affairs to have a better and more comprehensive understanding of the roots of changes and transformations that have significant political implications.
Yeah, I think that this is actually when I read the book, I thought to myself, this is, you know, in some ways part of the reason that I moved away from political science and into anthropology is because political science lives at this kind of macro level and has a way of often missing all of this activity that's going on at a much more micro level. And you see this also with economics. And I think of some of the things that I've seen, like, for example, patterns of gift giving in the little, you know, in Japan or really where I do my work are really interesting. And you watch as objects move around, you know, people will bring a gift to somebody's house. And in Japan, the custom is that you don't open the gift. You just set it aside and say, thank you. And that same gift may wind up at somebody else's house later in the day.
Wow.
And yeah, and there's this kind of really interesting flow of sort of social engagement that's happening through the gifts. And I think political engagement also can work this way. But if you're always up at that higher level, you miss all that stuff.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So I think this is one of the things I really enjoy about the book is that it really gets into the nitty gritties of these kinds of very, you know, detailed interactions that people have on a daily basis that are politically charged. And one of the things that's, I think, really interesting in the book is you spend a lot of time focusing on entrepreneurial activity at the local level. And, you know, as I read the book, I found myself feeling that the context you're looking at is just teeming with entrepreneurial activity, in part stimulated by the difficult political situation as people are trying to figure out how to get by. And one of the things that struck me is that the entrepreneurial activity is really not motivated by the types of things that I think most Americans typically associate with entrepreneurialism, things like getting rich or personal satisfaction or attaining early retirement. And this is actually something that I've also found in my own work on entrepreneurial ecosystems in rural Japan, that the motivations for entrepreneurial activity can be quite different depending on the cultural context, and certainly different from those that are often expressed in American academic and business literature on the topic. And so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what you see as motivating entrepreneurial activity among the people with whom you worked in Myanmar and how you think that might differ from entrepreneurialism. United States?
Yes, this is a great question. Entrepreneurial activities, I believe, are shaped by political and economic contexts within which one finds oneself. So, unlike in America, where you have more established rules, regulations, and well-established procedures, where you can borrow money from the government or banks to start your businesses, and where you have very much a predictable political and economic environments that allow people to plan and to accumulate resources a majority of people in countries like Burma operate within these unpredictable environments and with very limited economic resources. You have laws and rules and regulations, but they're not always strictly enforced. And sometimes policy can be mended and twisted depending on the individual local authorities that you are dealing with. So most of the small scale, and here I'm only focusing on small scale family-based entrepreneurs, because there are also a handful of activities that took place within the medium and large scale businesses. Yes. So most small-scale family-based entrepreneurs tend to focus on making additional income to survive rather than to expand their activities and to accumulate wealth. And that's what differentiates the entrepreneur activities in countries like Burma and those in the United States. And the small-scale entrepreneur activities in Burma tend to engage in activities that do not require lots of investment. And that can be easily done or that can be easily incorporated within their existing schedules and activities. So you find that many small-scale entrepreneur activities would gear toward activities like setting up home-based grocery or snack shops or raising, chicken and pigs or planting some cash crops in your backyards or setting up a food stall. Or having a home-based weaving, sewing, and hairdressing activities at home. And most of these are usually done by women so that they can incorporate these activities into their household daily activities. So in many situations, you could end up in a situation where almost everyone in this village or in a neighborhood try to sell the same goods or compete for the same customers, which eventually defeat the purpose of making additional income.
Yeah, I thought your own experience doing as a pig broker, I think, really kind of captures this. Though, is one of the things that you obviously must have done is whether it was overt or not, you analyzed the market, looked at where there was a need, and said, "Okay, I can do that." And figured out how to address that need, which then turned into a way to make income. And that's pretty much a definition of what an entrepreneur does, is you look at a market and say, this is a need. Now, what's interesting is that it's a need, in this case, that's in some ways, very emotional, very cultural, that people become attached to their pigs, and so they can't slaughter them. But that's very much, I think, a context-dependent example of entrepreneurialism.
Yes. And I think back, if I look back, I was very resourceful. I identified the areas that, I have certain advantage, right? I know this person who can slaughter pigs. And I also have parents who can provide me with additional startup cash. But not many people are in that kind of situation. So unfortunately, in many situations, all these small-scale activities just tend to focus on, what other people have done, right? Not having the resources and the capacity to identify the areas where they can fill the niche and they can fully advantage and satisfy a demand for particular goods and services.
Yeah. I think it's interesting as you get into this discussion of entrepreneurs, you do something I found really quite fascinating. You divide entrepreneurs into two broad groups in terms of the way that they sort of engage in actions or acts of loyalty. And you talk about those who exhibit loyally acceptant behavior as being people who are generally satisfied with their lot and with most official requirements for doing business, like registering your activities or paying government fees. But they also try to do things that are aimed at improving their relationships with government officials through gift giving and cultivation of personal networks and even bribery. And you contrast this with people who are grudgingly loyal, or entrepreneurs who are grudgingly loyal, who comply with formal and informal requirements of doing business, but they do it hesitant. And you note that differentiating these groups can be quite difficult at times. And so I'd like you to talk a bit about how these different approaches work out in daily economic life in Myanmar, how they influence entrepreneurial behavior and even success.
Mm-hmm. Actually, these terms are not my original terms. Mm-hmm. I'm inspired by a political scientist by the name of Kelly Tsai, who wrote a book titled Capitalism Without Democracy. And this is about China. And her book questions the conventional wisdom that showed that capitalism can promote democracy because entrepreneurs are more likely to oppose government restrictions and heavy regulations and are more favorable to environment that ensure private property rights, innovation, and creativity. So according to this line of argument, businesses can only survive and prosper under free and democratic government. But Tsai finds that this is not really happening in China due to the positions and activities of Chinese entrepreneurs that are not favorable to democratic reforms, either because they display loyalty to the state or they prefer to rely on their own rather than using collective efforts to resolve their business difficulties or they prefer to address the interests of their families and their individuals. Needs rather than advocating for larger political reforms. And Tsai offer different types of Chinese entrepreneurs and argue that the perpetuation of this communist regime has to do with entrepreneurs who comply willingly or those who accept the legitimacy of the communist government and those who comply grudgingly. And in her book, she seems to describe these different types of entrepreneurs in a very, you know, clear-cut ways. In Myanmar, however, and especially under the military rule, which lasted until 2010, it's very difficult to differentiate entrepreneurs who comply willingly from those who did so grudgingly. First of all, it was not a practical thing for me to conduct interviews and survey to identify whether people comply willingly or grudgingly. But I have seen most medium and large-scale businesses do almost the same thing simultaneously. Almost all of them tend to cultivate particular relationships with, you know, relevant state authorities. Almost all of them tend to evade government regulations, government taxes. Almost all of them bribe authorities to obtain special privileges. And almost all of them complain about government in private. So it's very difficult to tell whether these behaviors are a sign of the level of support given to the government or just self-interested activities to accumulate their wealth. And I hope that these type of activities can be studied more systematically under a more free and democratic government. But under the military government, it was very difficult to, you know, to really differentiate people who comply willingly or people who comply grudgingly.
So I'm curious, how did you manage to do this study? In the context of you were doing this while the military government was still going on?
Yes.
So how did you get permission to do the study? I'm curious how you kind of managed to conduct the study.
Burma was under very restricted political environment until I would say 2010. It was very difficult to conduct research. But one can, as an ex-citizen of Myanmar, I'm able to go back to the country almost every year, sometimes twice a year, to do research. You will be okay. The government is very paranoid. The military government was very paranoid about what had been written critically about them. So they would have a blacklist where, you know, there would be there's individuals who are critical of government will be you know, banned from entering the country. So that's the situations before 2010, 2011. But I was still able to go back into the country because I was very careful not to openly criticize the government, the military government openly. And many of the things that I focus on, many of the writings that I focus tend to be, I would say, non-political activities, right? Not necessarily on human rights violations, the abuse and the exploitations of the military, but more on, you know, everyday life experiences, people's experiences as particular religious ethnic groups, and I was also very careful about how I analyze and how I summarize and how I present my findings. So throughout the military government and until now, I was never banned from entering the country. And I could go there, you know, as a visiting the country, and I will still be traveling around the country to observe, to talk to people, to do some interviews. But I was very careful about keeping the identity of the people who come into contact with me in order to ensure their safety and well-being.
Yeah, that's I think. Of course, one of the most important things when we do any kind of human subjects research. And,
yes.
I think it's also, the example here shows us, how the context also shapes what we can do. And in some ways, it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the overarching sort of macro political context is part of the reason you wound up being able to focus on this micro level of daily political activity. Which really opens up a whole new way of different way of thinking about what we're doing in terms of politics. Would you say that makes sense?
Yes, that does. And that was really my purpose, is to link the connections, the relationship between macro level analysis and micro level analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, and you do it really well. It's something that I think is, it really comes through very strongly in the book. And one of the things I think is related to this is you talk about you discuss the issue of voice in both individual and collective efforts to pressure for economic and political change and the importance of voice. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what you mean by this concept and also describe some of the different ways in which voice is deployed among different actors in your field site. And I kind of found myself wondering if entrepreneurial activity itself might be thought of as a kind of voice in the way that you describe it in the book. And so could you talk more about that?
Yes. The term voice is not a new term in political science or economics discipline. Albert Hirschman, who is an economist, in his book titled Is It Voice and Loyalty?, use the term voice to discuss this as one of the strategies employed by firms or businesses against the state or government. So voice is, to me, according to my definition, is a situation where people speak out either individually or collectively to express their grievances and to advocate for change. And, this could take various forms. But since Hirschman came up with that term voice, different research and studies use and interpret the term voice differently. But in my definition, voice is a situation where people speak up, openly, right, to either express their grievance or to advocate for particular policy change. And that could take many forms, either through formal institutions, such as through government agencies, courts, or informal institutions, such as contacting influential local leaders, using social media and human rights groups to make your voice heard. So under the authoritarian government, many people use this voice strategy as their last option. They try to comply with regulations. They try to accommodate whatever stringent regulations that are imposed on there, or they would sometimes use what I refer to as passive resistance to make their lives more tolerable. And the passive resistance are different from fights. They're less subtle, right? Which could include evading regulations, evading forced labor, or paying taxes. So I don't consider most of the entrepreneur activities as a form of vice, according to my own definition, because I see that some of these entrepreneurial activities, especially the one that took place under authoritarian regime, are focused either on complying, right? Trying to be innovative, but still trying to accommodate the system, existing situations by making the situations more tolerable, or their passive resistance forms of activities that include a more subtle, form of resistance, such as bribing authorities. And these can be differentiated by my definition of vice, where people, openly engage in protests or, make their grievances known through official channels or unofficial channels, such as social media or human rights groups.
So, or demonstrating in protest,
right, demonstrating,
things like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I guess what we've seen over the past week is an example of,
right.
In the U.S., is an example of voice by that definition. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you know, as I look at the book, it represents what I think of as a very ethnographically rich study, or what an anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, refers to as thick description. There's enormous detail in the content as you work through the book, and it really brings the reader into a feeling of very close proximity with life in the parts of Myanmar that where you did your work. And you note that people deal with the economic stresses that they face, or as they deal with these economic stresses, ordinary citizens draw on a variety of support systems and social networks that are largely based on diffused or horizontal relationships of mutual indebtedness and obligation. This is actually something I found quite interesting because I see, and of course in a very different context in Japan, a very similar kind of thing where there's this kind of ongoing web of indebtedness and obligation that shapes how all sorts of different activities, whether political, economic, or just social engagement, happen. And the example I gave a little bit earlier of gift giving is part of this. You bring a gift to someone's house when you visit because it creates that kind of mutual interconnection of obligation. Of course, when the person comes back to your house at some point, they bring a gift, and this kind of keeps going back and forth. And I'm kind of curious about how you conducted research on these networks. What sort of methodologies, what sorts of ideas did you bring to looking at how the relationships work, and also how they form a kind of daily political economy that shapes and constrains behavior for people who live in the area that you studied?
Yes, this is also another very good question, John.
Thank you.
So these support networks are greatly influenced. The analysis greatly influenced the ways, greatly influenced by my own upbringing, where we use these resources in order to deal with economic challenges. So in contrast to rich countries where supports are usually provided by government, right, either in the form of food stamps, unemployment benefits, free healthcare, financial aid to students, poor countries tend to rely on support from family, neighbors, community, and religious organizations. And diffuse and horizontal form of social support is a common practice in countries like Burma that has very limited economic resources. And it involves everyday forms of assistance or a simple random act of kindness that one shows to members of the family, neighbors, and strangers. For instance, it's not uncommon to find grandparents taking care of their grandchildren whose parents work abroad or in remote areas, or to see community organizations providing assistance to members for emergency help and assistance. So under this kind of diffuse form of social support, everyone is a receiver as well as a giver. I have seen an elderly woman who was supported by six of her children, but she also supported her one married son who was struggling financially. And these forms of social support is also based on expectations of reciprocity, in that whoever under stress or under difficulties will be helped and supported by those who are more fortunate, with the expectations that the favor will return when their situations improve. So I began to appreciate these types of social support system based on my experience, and especially after living in America for many years, where responsibility to help the poor and the elderly are placed on government rather than on the family, the community, and the neighbors. So I started to pay particular attention to this type of social and community support. And by making a more systematic list of these activities, whenever I go back to the country and whenever I travel around the country, I will be mainly looking at these particular activities when I stay at villages and when I travel all over the country. And this way I was able to compile, and which I was not really surprised that, you know, these practices are very, I found that these practices were very prevalent. They were very crucial in the environment that lacked sufficient support from the government. But some of these widespread practices can also place tremendous stress on individuals who are under social obligations to be responsible for members of families, ethnic religious groups who are less fortunate than they are. So it does have some, you know, positive and negative aspects to it.
Yeah, that's been my experience in studying, particularly aging in rural Japan, is that, you know, there's kind of the reciprocity that goes on also can be very constraining. So, you know, in Japan, traditionally it's the eldest son, although an awful lot has changed, that's expected to take care of mom and dad when they get old.
Yes.
But that also really constrains his ability to pursue a career, to do the things he wants to do in life. And on the other hand, he also traditionally was the one who received all of the inheritance. That's not the way it works now. But, you know, one of the things I found in my own work in Japan is, as I look at this kind of very sort of reciprocity-oriented way of engaging in social interactions, where there is this sense of indebtedness and obligation, it seems to me that people tend to have, a very strong sort of sense or radar about the needs of other people. They tend to be very other-oriented in some ways.
Right.
And for me, that seems very different from the United States, where people tend to be very kind of turned in on their own specific needs. And I think we see it in things like, you know, voting, where people vote for their personal needs rather than for the society's needs. Do you see that in Myanmar as well?
Yes, I would say in terms of, you know, I would say ethnic identity is very prevalent, and that's where people mobilize various activities based on, you know, ethnic identity and religious identity. And both ethnic and religious organizations have been able to provide a variety of assistance, but they tend to be based exclusively on this one particular, you know, organizations or faith groups, then being very inclusive about it. So, and sometimes, you know, that could also put a lot of stress and strains on individuals who are members of these particular ethnic and religious groups, because they are automatically, you know, bound by their responsibility, their obligations to these larger collective communities rather than to themselves as individuals.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing with Japan, is that you don't have the kind of ethnic diversity that you see in Myanmar or the United States, or, you know, you're obviously ethnic groups in Japan, but overall, they're a fairly small proportion of the population. You also don't have much religious diversity.
Yeah.
The vast majority of Japanese they're Buddhist and Shinto at the same time. They do both. And they don't, culturally, there's very little sense of exclusivity in religious belonging. So people don't really feel like, oh, my religious group is the right one and other ones are the wrong, or somehow my identity is as a Buddhist as opposed to something else. That sounds different from Myanmar. It sounds like there's a stronger sense of that kind of religious cohesion.
Right. That's correct. Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's something that's always struck me about Japan.
Yeah.
Is the way Japanese engage religious institutions and religious behavior is really quite different from many parts of the world. They don't rely too much on a sense of belief as being at the core of things. It's more the rituals that you do that matter. If you do the rituals, you're fine. It doesn't matter too much whether you identify as Buddhist or Shinto or whatever. Some people it matters, but so in the conclusion, you note that Myanmar is gradually moving towards a more open political system with the installation of a democratically elected government for the first time in over half a century. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about where you think the country is headed and what might be expected in the near future in terms of changes in daily life for people living in Myanmar. And I'm particularly interested in any thoughts you might have on how social media might be influencing daily life and shaping the direction of social, economic, and political change, and even maybe contributing to these kinds of daily entrepreneurial activities.
Yes. So definitely we can say that Myanmar has become more democratic and freer since 2011. And especially since 2015, when the opposition party took over the government. But it is still a democratic, semi-democratic, semi-authoritarian country. The military still have control over security sectors and major political policy decision-making. 25% of all the legislative seats are reserved for the military. And the country also continued to experience armed conflicts in various parts of the regions. But I would say that democratic reforms have improved the life of ordinary people to the extent that elected governments are now more accountable and responsive to the needs of the ordinary poor people. They're providing more basic necessities and livelihood opportunities. And poor people are now having more venues to voice their grievances and to advocate for changes. So one of the sources estimated that there are now 22 million internet users in Myanmar, which is like a spike in the usage. This is about over 40% of the populations. So access to social media creates more democratic space because it offers the tools and access to less privileged people to express their grievances, to complain, and to share news that would otherwise have been controlled by the central authorities. But like what have happened in other countries, social media and democratic structures can also foster the spread of misinformation and extremist views, especially if these views are expressed by the majority group, which shows very little toleration for opposing viewpoints or minority views. I also don't expect many of these coping strategies that are used by ordinary people to disappear overnight, because Burma is still one of the poorest countries in the world. And recently, the World Bank just predicted that the poverty rate will be increased by 5% due to the effects of COVID. So despite the ongoing democratic reforms and more opportunities for ordinary and poor people, I think that coping strategies that I have mentioned in my book will continue to exist for indefinite period of time, I would say.
Yeah, certainly. And COVID, of course, has had this, you know, kind of effect all over the place of really changing or I guess intensifying problems that many countries are having.
Yes.
Or like in the United States, just, you know, having basically failed to address it effectively and generating new problems that maybe didn't need to be there. So basically, I guess then you don't see major changes in the near future.
To some extent, I see changes in terms of people having more venues to express their grievances, government being more accountable and more responsive. So in terms of political realms, I see some major changes, but in terms of regular everyday-to-day economic activities, I don't see a lot of major changes taking place.
Yeah. Well, so we've covered a fair amount of ground here, but this is, as I've said, really tremendously detailed and rich study, and we've really covered the surface. And so I'm curious, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to raise for our listeners in terms of your research or your book?
Yes. So I organize, in my book, I organize coping mechanism into four categories. Economic coping, which are efforts to cut costs, expand income. Second category is social coping. We talk about this. This is a reliance on family and community support. Third, political coping, which is about dealing with authorities who are responsible for implementing policies that impact on your economic activities, and psychological coping. And I find that psychological coping to be a significant aspect of coping mechanism in poor countries like Myanmar, where the role of religion and religious institutions play a prominent role in people's life, whether they are Buddhists, which is the majority of the populations, or Christians or Muslims or animists. In my research, I find that religious teachings in this country provide people with, you know, inspiration and boost their morale in times of economic hardships. For instance, praying and meditation empower them and give them hope and motivation for a chance of advancement that did not exist before. And so to this extent, I find that religion can produce either resilient promotion or problem-solving skill, and by providing people a sense of stability, purpose, contentment, and empowerment. And religion can also have positive effects on physical health. So this is something that you don't see it on a widespread, larger scale in rich and Western countries where people rely less on religion to help solve their economic or political problems. Finally, I also like to emphasize that coping strategies that I found in Myanmar are not unique. You can find that all over the world, especially in poor and authoritarian countries. And your experiences of doing research in Japan demonstrate that. I remember I gave a talk at the University of Michigan at the Southeast Asian Brownback Seminar, and one of the attendees, who was an elderly lady, remarked that the strategies that I talk about reminded her of the strategies that her mother used to utilize when she was growing up during the World War II in America. So this is not uniquely a Myanmar situation. So at the end of the book, I draw comparison from countries with similar level of political and economic situations, especially those in Asia, Latin America, and Africa, with particular purpose in mind for policymakers. Because my argument is that, you know, these coping strategies, such as pooling resources or engaging in extra income activities, entrepreneurial activities, can empower people and make them more resilient, autonomous individual. But many of these coping strategies can be self-defeating and can have negative impacts on environment and on democratic practices. For instance, efforts to cut costs on food, education, and healthcare can be counterproductive and can perpetuate poverty. Also, the widespread practice of paying bribes to authorities to either extract special privileges or to disregard particular rules and regulations can also deepen inequality and injustice, since people who cannot afford to pay bribes are the ones who need government's protections the most. So I think these are the main, the main arguments that I want to have them come across in the book, that, so that to emphasize that the book has not just, some theoretical implications that can be, that travel across the, different periods and different regions, but also has some policy implications for policymakers to have a more informed decision-making when they deal with the issue of poverty.
Yeah, I think that that's actually one of the things that's really important in the book. And although it's outside of my main area of focus, I've read interesting things about, for example, small-scale gold mining in some countries in Latin America and how important this is to the well-being of the people that are doing this. But at the same time, there are problems generated because they use mercury in the gold mining, and this pollutes the environment. And of course, it's the environment that they're living in. And so there's this very difficult question of how to balance their need to develop what they need to develop with policy type things that are that also affect them. And,
exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And I found similar situations in Burma as well. So one of the self-defeating coping strategies that I talk about were the ones that involve in, intensifying efforts to extract natural resources, whether they're, a forest and depleting, resources from the forest or from, the water or other resources that used to be available.
Yeah. So what do you have planned next? What is your current research and what kind of plans do you have for writing in the future? I guess as chair of the department, maybe you don't have any plans.
Well, research is my passion. So even though I'm chair of the department, I make sure that I have some time to focus on research. Now I'm currently working on the impact of internal migrations on Myanmar's intercommunal relationships. There has been increasing rate of internal migration inside the country due to civil war, natural disaster, and economic difficulty. So you see that increasing movement of populations across the country. And I'm looking at how this movement of populations affect the local host economy and the relationship between native and migrant populations in the country. And this has larger theoretical and broader implications for both developed and developing countries that have experienced large influx of and inflow and outflow of populations. And it's more important for countries like Burma, where ethnic identity is very polarized, politicized, and can have serious impacts on the relationship between migrants and native populations who come from different ethnicities. So I'm currently working on that topic. And it's really, I feel like this topic really allows me to look at the two areas of my expertise, which are ethnic politics and political economy.
Well, that sounds really fascinating. I'm looking forward to the next book already. I think it'll be
that
really
means like interesting. Another 10 years.
Yeah, it can be like that. It's when one gets involved in particularly academic administration, it tends to slow everything else down. And I think for people like you and I who really, really enjoy the research side of things, it always feels like it's tugging at us to get back to it and focus on that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Oh.
Well, Ardith, I want to thank you for taking the time to join me on the New Books Network. I say to our audience that anyone interested in political economy, development, or even culture in Myanmar, because there's a great deal of depth about the Myanmar culture that floats through this book. I think anyone will find this a very insightful and also very intellectually provocative read. It's been a pleasure talking with you about this very fascinating and important book. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John, for your kind and recommendations and for giving me the opportunity to talk about my book. This actually is the first time I talk about my book. Since the book came out. So thank you so much. It's really a pleasure.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thank you.